Kaya FM Podcast. The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng Bill on Kaya FM 95.9.
A very good evening to you and welcome to the Law Report. My name is Michael Motsoeneng Bill. Good to be with you today. Today we have a special show where, you know, from time to time we do profile shows where we talk to esteemed South Africans. And this evening I have the privilege and the honor of speaking to Judge Dennis Davis, whom you'd know very well either from judgments or, failing that, from your television screen. Where he's done lots of work on television spanning over many years. So it's a very great privilege for me to welcome on the Law Report Judge Dennis Davis. Judge, thank you very much for joining me on the Law Report.
No, thank you for honoring me by inviting me.
Well, you know, often when I do these interviews, it's a great fascination, and the question that always pops up in my mind is, you know, how do you start talking about such a long and elaborate journey? And the obvious answer always seems to be, well, in the beginning.
Yes, good point.
So when I read your profile it seems, you know, you've played in four spaces, and not only have you played in four spaces, but I think you've played leadership roles in four different spaces. One is television, two is academia, and three is in the judiciary. But that's not where it started. At some point, you were an advocate. You were admitted at some point. So maybe let's just talk to, you know, so you've got these four spaces in which you've existed, and not only that, and have excelled in. And I'd like to examine the makings of that, how it all started, and perhaps talking about your life, how it began.
Thanks, Michael. Well, let me sketch that. You know, it's an interesting question, of course. If you're a white South African like me, unquestionably, you had advantages that nobody else had in the country. And I think one needs to acknowledge that, realize that, and that becomes rather important in fashioning a life right from the beginning. Mm. But I can say that in my case, in terms of the white community, and more particularly the Jewish community from where I come, if it is possible to say this, I came from sort of Jewish working class stock, which was kind of unusual. I'll explain in a moment. Unusual because most of the Jewish community where I lived, which was in Cape Town, were either in business or in the professions or medicine or whatever the case. My father was a major mechanic, and my mother was a typist. And
your mother was a?
She was a typist at a law firm.
Mm. Typist.
So,
yeah.
So what I'm saying is that I was quite acutely aware from an early stage of the class differences, mm-hmm. not the race ones. I accept that. Mm-hmm. That itself came to me because I went to a Jewish day school, a Herzliya in Cape Town. That's where they sent me, where I certainly realized the class differences between people who had fancy motor cars and us who had a very, very old car that barely went. And only went because my father was a motor mechanic.
And I can imagine the mechanics are famous for their cars, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, my dad, with every old car, they taught me to drive, and they graduated for that. He never taught me how to fix a car, which was worse, because he was determined that I shouldn't become like him. You know, which was really weird. I wish he had taught me. Anyway, the point was that at a Jewish day school like mine, one of the things that was drummed into us, of course, was the history, Jewish history, and particularly the Holocaust and not the Nazi Germany. Remember, I was at school in the 1960s, which meant that was less than 20 years after the end of the Second World War, especially in the memory of people who were teaching me. And that, there were photographs of the Nazis essentially arresting, you know, small children. Mm. And I remember so distinctly, you know, my mother worked in the center of the city, and we didn't have any domestic help. So because she was a typically Jewish mother, she insisted that I go and have lunch in the office. And the reason why I mention this is because it was in Adley Street in Cape Town. And I remember many times seeing police brutally assault, as a small child, brutally assault black people who were clearly presumably, allegedly, in breach of the influx control laws. Mm-hmm. And that stayed with me. And it didn't take a rocket scientist to essentially equate that with what had happened to my own community during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, those two features, if you wish, a sense of not coming in a white perspective, although I can see then you can say to black people I was very privileged, and history, but it really shaped my early life. And by the time I got to University of Cape Town, where I did study law, I really wanted to be a psychiatrist, but medicine wasn't for me, and so I landed up by doing law. At law school, I certainly began to essentially realize that those two particular perspectives that had come from my early childhood were now playing an increasing influence. So that certainly by the time I got to my final year of university, I think that I had certainly by then assumed, if you could call it, a Marxist perspective of the world. It was certainly quite prevalent there. Hmm. And if I could add one other thing which was very influential, and oddly enough played a role when I had my altercation with Barney Pitana and we engaged and made up, and of course the highest respect for him, but we created the icon some many years ago. I pointed out to him afterwards that in 1970, my first year as a student at the University of Cape Town, I had attended a very famous seminar where he and Steve Biko had basically engaged with Mises and was taking the view that white liberals couldn't tell blacks what to do, and in fact began to introduce the concept of black consciousness. Mm. That had an enormous influence on me. It's the only time I ever met Biko. An enormous influence on me as an 17 and 18-year-old. And all of that combined meant that by the time I got to final year, I realized that to a large degree, ordinary law, just being an ordinary lawyer in a law firm, was really not for me. And I really wanted to get into academic life, because I should say this. There were only two or three things that a lawyer who is progressively minded could do when I came out of law school in 1975. You could, if you were lucky enough, go to one of the few progressive law firms, because the Legal Resources Center, it only started shortly thereafter, so that wasn't the place.
Mm.
You could, as some of my sort of heroic comrades did, drift into the trade union movement.
Mm.
Or thirdly, you could go into academic life and make your contribution there. And in order to get into academic life, because I had been, to be perfectly frank, not exactly a good boy in terms of the establishment of my faculty, although I did very well in my final year, I didn't get any bursaries. So I had, in order to go and study overseas, I was reliant very much on my own money. I mean, I'd gone through university on bursaries because my parents couldn't afford it. So the result was that when I got out of law school, I thought I have to get myself a job where I can save sufficient money to go overseas and study. It was easier then because the land was worth a lot more than it is today. And to cut a long story short, the best job I could get, which ironically in many ways played a massive role in my life, was I went to work for the Old Mutual, and I learned to become a tax consultant.
Hmm.
And after 2 years as a tax consultant, the university needed a tax teacher. And that's how I got a job at the University of Cape Town in 1977, which is where my academic career began. And of course, it didn't take very long, even though I kept on teaching tax, which I'd certainly be happy to do, to move into more politically orientated legal topics, such as labor law and legal philosophy. And you're right, I then got admitted to the bar, I think, in 1979. But my practice was essentially tax and, to some extent, labor law.
Mm. Now,
and that's where it started. That's where it started.
I mean, you've said so many things, and one of which I want to touch on, where you say at the school that you went to, the events of the Holocaust were impressed upon, you know, you guys as pupils then. And I wondered whether you understood the reasons why the school was so determined to drill down that part of Jewish history. And where I'm going with this question is if you understood what the objective was, do you think that as regards the black experience with apartheid and colonialism, do you think that we had a vision or an objective of how do we use our history to achieve whatever end?
Yeah, it's a great question. I can answer that in two ways. At the same time at the school, we had a very remarkable teacher. He's worth naming because he deserves to be named. Mm. You know, often we don't recognize people who had a big influence on our lives. His name was Mark Cohen, and he was, strange enough, a Hebrew teacher in the name. But in my span of 7 years at university, some of these, and he taught English. Mm. And we spent an entire year discussing Cry the Beloved Country. Mm. And whilst it is true that when you look at that book now, in 2021, of course, it's a very liberal text, which has serious problems attached to it. But put yourself in 1965 as a 13, 14-year-old, mm. studying a book which was certainly not available at the public schools and the national and the Christian national education. Mm. And we spent a whole year, and to his great credit, he essentially broadened the scope of the book to talk about, locate the book in terms of South African politics. So there we were, 13 or 14 years old, actually talking about the tragedy of apartheid South Africa. And then, in 1966, I went on a school trip to Israel, mm. where we bought, a number of us, a banned book by Brian Bunting called The Rise of the South African Reich, which paralleled Nazi Germany to much of what was going on in apartheid, certainly pre-1939, mm. pre-extermination period, in other words, in the early period. And of course, it didn't take a genius to kind of make those links. Did the school deliberately do that? I certainly think Mr. Cohen was determined to give us a political context which we otherwise wouldn't have. But no, I think their purpose was a different one in the main. It always has been a different purpose, which was essentially to look inward. That it was a contradiction in terms, because whilst the school education looked inward, in a sense, looking after the interests of the Jewish community, there were sufficient teachers there, and the principal too, who sort of understood the dialectic of looking outward at the same time. Mm. And although they never drew the links directly, except as I want to suggest when we studied Cry the Beloved Country in Standard 7, those links to, you know, questioning kids who were now being taught to be critical became fairly apparent.
Just to go back to what Steve Biko stood for, which was, you know, when he spoke about white liberals, he says that you go and you enjoy your white beaches and then come back to the township and preach to us. And I'm just trying to put that and distinguish between different, I guess, groupings of white people. There's obviously the Jewish, the Afrikaans, and then the English at the time. What is it about your Jewishness that made you and others like you, because there were quite many. You know, I don't have any sort of statistical backup for this, but there's a greater number of Jewish people that supported the struggle relative to, you know, Afrikaans, etc. What is it about your Jewishness that made you and others like you not enjoy the beach fully?
That's a good question, Michael. I think the answer is a number of answers. I was a slightly unusual case. Interesting enough, I was on a seminar just the other day with L.B. Sachs, and we were talking about this. L.B. Sachs obviously being Jewish too. He came from an entirely different Jewish background to mine, in the sense that I had gone to a Jewish day school. I'd had a Jewish education. I studied the tradition. I studied the Talmud with a rabbi after I came out of school. And in a sense, to this day, you know, fairly steeped within that tradition. I know the only other Jew, in South Africa, who has, in a sense, broadly my politics and a deep knowledge, probably even deeper than mine, on matters Jewish, is Stephen Friedman, who's well known. So we were slightly unusual, I think, Stephen and I, because we were in both, as it were, the tradition and outside. But I do think, even for those Jews, you are talking about the broader activists, there was something about the history. There was something about, you could draw a series of conclusions. You could either say that what had happened in the Holocaust to the Jewish community and to others at the hands of the Nazis essentially meant that you worried about your own community and didn't worry about anybody else. The world is owed you a living. Or you could say, draw the universal lessons, which is that in fact all should be treated with equal concern and respect, and that the history taught you that. Many years before the Holocaust, Rosa Luxemburg, the famous Marxist, Jewish Marxist, had said, it's not that I'm not concerned about Jewish issues, but the truth is I don't have enough space to only worry about Jewish issues, and I've got to look at civilization as a whole. And I think for many of the Jews who were prominent in the struggle, that broader ethos is particularly important in one way or the other. And of course, I'm terribly proud of the fact, not from an ethnocentric point of view, but I am proud of the fact that somewhere along the line, it is true that every white person who was at Livonia trialist when Mr. Mandela et al. Were tried, every white trialist is Jewish.
Yeah.
And so something in
and
that
stands out.
Yeah, and I'm not proud. I'm not an ethnocentric. Ah, we were better than you. Not in the slightest. But it does seem to me that your question is a good one. That tradition, in some way or another, spoke to people. And you know, it's terribly important that we realise that. I mean, because it seems to me that's one of the things that's missing in South Africa, is that you know, you should learn from history so that when there has been oppression of your group or a group of which you suffered, then that broader universal commitment should in sense be with you for the rest of your life.
Could it be also that in white South Africa, as a Jewish man, there were certain tables in which you couldn't sit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I came out, you know, there used to be, I mean, it's very interesting. A few years ago, I was presiding in a Labour Appeal Court case, and my two colleagues were Judge King's Lawview and John Schlorpe. And we were in Durban, and King's Lawview, being from Durban, took us to the Durban Club. And when we went in, I said to my two colleagues, who were somewhat bemused, until I explained it to them, you do realize that 20 years ago, none of us would have been allowed in here. You know, and they looked at me and I explained that many of these clubs didn't allow Jews in either. So yes, there was that sense of exclusion.
We're not going to give Jewish people the status of previously disadvantaged.
We are not previously disadvantaged. As I've been trying to suggest, we were advantaged. But it's precisely because we were advantaged on the one hand, and understood to some extent the idea that you weren't quite the same,
yeah,
that it irritates me enormously. In fact, that's the wrong word. Angers me enormously that there are many members of my own Jewish community who do not draw the obvious lessons.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to Judge Dennis Davis, and we're profiling the judge. We're getting to understand the man behind what you might have seen in judgments, what you might have seen in newspapers or even television. I want to take a break, and when we come back, we continue our conversation.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back to The Law Report. I'm still speaking to my guest, Judge Dennis Davis. And before we went on the break, we'd really just covered a very, what I consider to be a very interesting conversation around just the time and space of being Jewish and coming up from university, 60s or so, during that time. And obviously juxtaposing it to, you know, various other times and various other people. So I want to just hop along, Judge, if I may.
Yeah.
There is obviously something before I hop along that I'm tempted to explore further. You mentioned that in this experience you started to identify with the Marxist theory, which mm-hmm. which is obviously something which is very central to our politics. In fact, the whole wars were waged in other parts because of this whole debate of Marxism, etc. Maybe just you know, talk to me about that.
Well, you see, I think that the question was, liberals thought that, you know, race is ultimately incompatible with capitalism, and that it's not, I'm crudifying, but I mean in simple terms, and that capitalism would ultimately work itself pure and that race would be eroded from the system. Marxists thought, broadly speaking, drawing from a very classic article that Harold Welty, who was one of the ANC intellectuals throughout his life, Harold Welty had written back in 72, in which he had linked the idea of apartheid to capitalist development, that the idea of racism was linked to the notion that you have a large surplus of cheap labor, which essentially could be used in the mines and in other parts of the country, and that to a large degree you couldn't separate the two. Capitalism and racism were inextricably linked. And that got people like myself, I was a small fry in a very interesting group who were far, who wrote masses of stuff over a fairly lengthy period in the 70s and 80s, and who were essentially broadly talking about the linkages between apartheid and capitalism, and more than that, the fact that South Africa had to be explained both in class and race terms, that the class and race overlapped. By the way, I still believe that to be true.
A very interesting thought that I had, particularly in relation to what you are saying, and I just want to explore it with you, where you say that there is a very strong relationship between capitalism and racism, and I don't know if I'm adding or it's a but to that theory, but I find that if you take South Africa today, we almost and I say this, you know, it's a considered view, it's not sort of one that I make recklessly. I think we are a nation which is, by and large, directionless. We have no common vision. We don't know what we meant to be doing as a combined people. And what I find things like racism have been good at doing, you know, the good that comes out of it, is it allows you to galvanize a people. Once somebody believes that they are better than somebody else, it seems an easy way for them to behave better. So you know, you are better than this people. And when you look at the fruits of oppression, racism, everywhere, whether it's Germany, I mean, Germany today is right up there. In fact, you know, if the Eurozone was to have a head, it'd be Germany, right? South Africa, whites, right up there, and America, slavery. You can pretty much traverse the world, and I guess for the English or the British, it was different because they just pretty much oppressed everybody that's not in their own country where they could. but it looks to me that this idea of you are better than somebody else propels them to actually behave better. And once you then use that, you're better than somebody else, but then this is your direction and this is where you need to be as a people. It seems to me a very successful way to get people to unite and behave in a particular direction. You are number one. You are the greatest. Your thoughts on that theory?
Well, I think you're right. As I start from the beginning, it's interesting you say that. I think we are directionless, and I think that if you took our constitution as a starting point, its very idea, inherent in everything, its very idea was in fact the reconstruction of South African identity. Mm. It was essentially to say that the identities, and I use that clearly, which we had beforehand, were completely destructive of a South African community. Mm. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't be proud of your heritage and me of mine. We've been speaking about that. Mm. But it does mean that we actually look at ourselves and say, we are in this boat together. Mm. And either we're going to, this boat is going to float, or in fact, it's going to sink. And we haven't got there. We haven't got there at all. Mm. And it does seem to me that the real conversation in South Africa is, how do we reconstruct that identity so that, yes, we are all better for it? Mm. That, in fact, all of us can say there's something special about being South African. We say that, but we say it from different perspectives. And there's very little sharing. And so the answer is, you know, we've got an intelligent debate about race. Race is a very important factor. It defines so much of the distribution, allocation and resources in society. But it doesn't explain everything. Certainly doesn't explain rent seekers. It transcends race. And it certainly doesn't justify conduct of a certain kind. So we've really got, I think, very seriously, to think through how can we have a kind of debate which actually then leads us into precisely what you're talking about, a relatively cohesive nation, which actually acts at its best, not at its worst. And it's possible that we are a long way away from that. We had an inkling of that when Mr. Mandela was around.
Yeah.
But we've got a lot of work to do. We've gone backwards, not forwards.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so many things. I think the frustrating thing for me, and maybe just as I move along to my next question, the frustrating thing is, it's one thing to find yourself in terrible circumstances as a country, generally, but it's quite another to find yourself in those very same circumstances when the potential is just so enormous. So I think for me, if I was, you know, to take my last breath now for the country, I think I would die a very sad man. Back to you.
You know, I don't want to live in a country where people are living on the margin, Michael. I really don't. I don't want to live in a country where the police kill Nathaniel Julius, a boy who had serious physical problems, and they killed him. I mean, you know, when that happened, I cried because I thought to myself, this is not the country I want to live in for me or my family. And I have to say that I found really interesting, I can just make the point, it has troubled me, is that in America when George Floyd died, Black Lives Matter emerged. And in fact, many white people, to their credit, came out and joined black people in saying Black Lives Matter. I saw very little of that in South Africa in total. The police cause Nathaniel Julius and others were killed. Where was the outrage from everybody, not just white people, I'm saying everybody? You know, we need to actually say we can do a lot better. And we've got the potential to do a lot better. This country can do remarkable things because it's frankly got remarkable people. People with, I mean, it's true, we've got people of great patience, great fortitude, great talent, but we're not using.
And we got capital. You hear that businesses are sitting on capital that they're not deploying.
No, lots and lots. You look at the balance sheets because there's no confidence. Now, you know, we can talk about why, but the fact of the matter is, you're dead right. All of that should be used to reconstruct our country so that, in a sense, the image that the Constitution had for us is something that becomes much more of a reality.
Now, back to the timeline. So now, you early careers, you take up academia because it's where you believe your purpose is better served. How does that then, and I think you do that from about 1977 odd, all the way, and as democracy knocks on our doors, talk to us at that, you know, leading up to that point, because what's fascinating about you is that you then become part of the team, and you are not just in one team, various teams that are appointed by our first president, and I deliberately didn't say democratic president. Our first president who then says, you know, I want you to work on this law, electoral laws, tax laws, competition laws. What was it about your work and your standing and your disposition that made you the right man?
I think I was lucky. Partly, I think, at that time, very different time to today, I think, people, and Mandela certainly, and the Mandela era, was people looked at what your record was. In other words, one of the things that I learned in helping in the trade union movement is that black workers would look at you when you first came to advise, etc., very suspiciously, thinking, I wonder if this person's a police spy. They soon worked out, because they were really smart, that you were on their side. And when you were on their side, it didn't bloody matter what the color of your skin was. You were with them. And they embraced you in all sorts of ways, which is why many of us thought that it was perhaps easier than we realized to get to a non-racial society. But it did mean that when democracy, well, democracy was about to dawn, and we were still in that interregnum period, it meant that the ANC and the Liberation Movement could draw on a whole lot of people who came from a variety of backgrounds. You know, hugely talented black people and talented white people, all of whom had the same agenda to make South Africa into a serious democracy. And why? I was, of course, part of that broad community. My one difference, which was lucky for me, is that I had been a commercial. I spoke about the tax side. And although I'd been doing all the political work, there were very few left-wing tax lawyers. Right, very few left-wing progressive people who had any knowledge of broad commercial. You must understand that for the vast majority of black lawyers, they had been discriminated against egregiously. So, to the extent that they transcended all the awful obstacles that were put in their place by apartheid, they were still never given the kind of briefs as they were advocates or the working clients in the commercial areas that white did. And so there you had me, in a sense, and that's true, benefiting from this egregious system, because there was, at that point, of course it's not true any longer, but at that point, there were so few people of progressive bent who understood anything about the commercial area that it was perfectly obvious that the ANC were going to say to someone like myself, help us with the tax policy. In relation to the electoral law, and the reason I got into that is because in 1991 I took over the Center for Applied Legal Studies from John Dugon, one of the heroes of the human rights struggle. And that institution had amongst it a whole range of remarkable people. So in that institution, broadly at that time, there was Holton Pheadle, there was Fink Haysen, there was Paul Benjamin, there was Tuli Modlin-Sena. They were all there. You know, in that institution broadly at that time, and most of us were then being used, as it were, in the CADESA period, and they just put me into the electoral laws and said, you better help out. I wasn't an expert, I had to become one. But it was because I was trusted to essentially look at things from a progressive democratic point of view that the Liberation Movement said we must use this expertise to the extent that it's available to us.
So earlier on, and I think in the preamble to this discussion, if you've just tuned in, I'm having a conversation with Judge Dennis Davis, and when I introduced him, I mentioned that he'd sort of played in four spaces: TV, which is broadcasting, academia, law, and also in the judiciary. But there's something that I ask, and I would obviously have an interest in this because I'm a lawyer. And Judge, that question is, when you take, for example, issues of tax, somebody would then call themselves a tax lawyer, but you seem to have done so much work in the tax, including writing some of the tax laws, but also in the same breath in competition, and in this, and in that, and in that. And I think often as lawyers, we ask ourselves the question, and we are asked by clients, what do you specialize in? And when I answer that question, I often say, well, I just choose what I don't want to do, and I do the following. As I answer, I get the sense that I lose their confidence because my list just goes on and on. And just as somebody who's played, I mean, tax is not only complex in and of itself, it's complex because even tax lawyers distinguish themselves as a VAT specialist, income tax, you know, international, blah, 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 it goes on. So how do you manage to have such a strong and leading role in so many spheres of law, which are to many quite specialized, and then also deal with the normal matters that came to you whilst you were at the bench?
Okay, that's an interesting question, and I'll tell you why. Because to a large degree, two things happened to me which were very fortuitous. One is because I taught law, and I was required to teach a whole lot of stuff outside of tax. Of course, I gravitated to legal theory, and I'll come back to that, the significance of that in a moment, and of course to labor law, because those are the two areas as where tax was a sort of way in, but the real political beef was in labor at that time, and to some extent in kind of puzzling out, which was Marxist legal theory or broader progressive legal theory. So what happens to me is that when democracy begins to dawn, obviously, as I've spoken about the tax, then what happens is that because I've done all this legal theory, two things emerge. One is that I'd majored in economics. I'd studied serious economics. Mm. And that meant there were very few lawyers who had done that. And in some of the legal theories I'd done, the law and economics school had been taught. So it wasn't a long leap to move from that to competition. And when Kevin Mannell, when he was the Minister of Trade and Industry, wanted some people, again, people from, as it were, a side that he felt was going to give him reliable progressive advice. But, you know, there were people like David Lewis, who was an economist and had been in the trade union movement, and myself, who essentially, strange enough, had done some work for David's union, but essentially had a law and economics background. It was perfectly clear that he was going to rely to some extent on us. So that's how competition came about. And then we had to work bloody hard to become a serious expert in it, and one's background helped, but that was how that happened. In relation to labor law, without teaching the damn thing, had done some practice and had taught in it for years and years and years. And then early on in my judicial career, Sandeen Tobo, who was then the acting drag president of the Labor Appeal Court, invited me there. My judge president refused to release me. But a year or two later, when Judge Zonda took over from Judge Tobo, then I did go there. So that's how that came about. And so, you know, and the constitutional law stuff was because if you were teaching legal theory, you taught constitutional theory. Mm. Very few people in South Africa had. So by the time the constitution emerged, I was just fortunate enough to be one of the people who was well acquainted with American and Canadian constitutional law, which suddenly became very important as we carved our own constitution. So I've just been incredibly lucky, Michael.
Hmm. Or hardworking, and which is something we'll talk about.
Well, you have to. you can't just bulldust everybody.
Let's take a break, Judge, and when we come back, I'm continuing my conversation with Judge Dennis Davis.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back to The Law Report. I'm still in conversation for the last 20 minutes with Judge Dennis Davis, and I'm worried that 20 minutes is simply not enough to traverse all the issues that I hope to have covered come 9 o'clock. But I'm going to give it a good shot nevertheless. So, I mean, when we talk about all of these things that you're doing, and I'm sure this question is not for the benefit of lawyers only. It's for the benefit of most professionals, most business people who are trying to make a success out of their lives, who are trying to build, you know, play their role in building this country. Family. Where's family in all of this?
Family is really very important. My wife, Claudette, has been absolutely heroic in putting up with all my nonsense. And I've got two fantastic kids. Yeah. Unfortunately, both of them are lawyers, which really upsets me. My daughter, actually, I think, you know, was fantastically talented at art, but decided, had a bad experience at school in that particular fashion. I'm sure many people will resonate with many. And she went into law. She's now doing a PhD at King's. And my son, I'm very proud of him too, just like I am of her, because he's going off to clerk at the Constitutional Court this year, the Chief Justice. So they're very, you know, I have incredibly close relationships with my wife and my children. You learn one thing about kids and family, is it doesn't take very long for them to tell you what an idiot you are. And I have to tell you that once your children become lawyers, they have great glee in pointing out, one, when you get overturned, and two, why you're wrong. But I mean, you know, to be honest, we're a pretty close unit. I don't come from a large family. I have one sister and a niece. So we don't really have a large, my parents are dead, and we don't have a large family. So, you know, our intimate family is very important. Sadly, my daughter's in London, my son's in Johannesburg. So we've suffered as well from that, like many others have. But, there's a very close family. My daughter's a fanatical Arsenal supporter, whereas my son and I, if Manchester United lose, it ruins our week.
Well, you had a good start to this week.
Oh, I'm in a very good mood now.
So here's something that I, you know, I was thinking as you were talking about your kids. So you're leaving the profession in one way, and I fear with all of these attacks on the judiciary, your children, and certainly for the balance of my career, we might have to contend with a very different judiciary and a very different legal system, because I sense, and I'm not sure if it's you share the sentiment, that there is an attack on the judiciary. What's your views, and if there is an attack, and do you think that attack is justified?
You know, it's an interesting question. Of course, there's an attack, and no, I don't think it's justified in the hell. Look, let me say this: judges make mistakes. We all do. I've certainly made a number in my career, and other judges do. That's why we have appellate bodies. And in fact, appellate bodies make mistakes. Constitutional Court makes mistakes, but that's the name of the game in every system. But by and large, I'm really proud of the fact that over the 23 years that I've been on the bench, we've done okay, and I'm very proud of many of my colleagues. And I think that during the state capture era, that there were many colleagues, many of them black colleagues, who clearly came under significant pressure, political pressure, and did magnificently. You know, when people complain, I say this is the best judiciary you've ever had, ever, because of, you know, what has been done. Now, that doesn't mean that that includes all, but it, as an institution. And yes, it is under attack. But it's under attack in the main from rent seekers. It's under the attack from people who benefited from the hollowing out of constitutional institutions. Mm. And by the way, that's not only true in South Africa. What has happened here is exactly what Donald Trump tried to do in America and still tries to do, at least his lunatic fringes do. It's true in Turkey, it's true in Hungary, it's true in Brazil, and to some extent even in the United Kingdom. There is a genuine attack on constitutional guardrails in many parts of the world, and populism seeks to take over in the guise of law, but it's not at all that. So yes, it's your generation, and to the extent that I'm still around, you know, for some years to come, hopefully, it's certainly all our tasks to actually realize that with all its imperfections, this is the best possible system we're ever going to have. And the judiciary does need support as an institution. It definitely does. Its own leadership will obviously have to be critical to this. And, of course, that, too, is an interesting question, because we do know that the present Chief Justice's term expires in September. So who takes over is going to be a matter of major moment. But all of that, judiciary can't on its own function without civil society at large realizing its importance and defending it. And that's why I was particularly encouraged to see that a new group of people came forward, a very eminent group, to protect and promote the Constitution. The more the better.
So you referenced the United States and what it had to deal with as regards Trump. And it seems to have survived. It seems to have triumphed.
Yes.
Will we?
Lucky,
will we?
Well, I think we will. Look, you know, I think it was once upon a time, Jan Smuts, not that he's my intellectual hero, but it is an interesting thing. Many, many years ago, apparently said South Africa neither the worst nor the best ever happens. We've been speaking about that earlier. But I do think we'll probably survive. And, you know, I was interviewing Rudy Cluddy the other day for a Daily Maverick program, and she made a very interesting point to me, which is that Twitter is not South Africa. Mm. And that we, in a sense, are obsessed by the Twitterati and not by the whole country. I think we will survive, because I think the vast majority of people realize that the broad framework within which we now operate is too important not to survive. And, you know, it's interesting to reflect that during the Zuma period, how many people of all kinds came out in the streets to actually protest what was going on. I think we will survive, but I have no doubt about it that it's going to be made difficult for us, and we're going to have to sustain significant attacks on the guardrails of democracy, on the courts, on other institutions which essentially protect democracy. Absolutely. And I still feel that the vast majority of people really are not going to assure this kind of naked populism and opportunism which is trying to exploit what are difficult conditions at present.
You know, and here I'd really like your help. When I in my career, I have had many situations where somebody is coming to you after having lost a case, say, help me mm-hmm. take it further. And from time to time, the prospective client would say, I think there was something wrong. You know, I think that judge took a cut or his hands were greased, and that magistrate this. And without even investigating the facts, I have jumped to the defense of our judges, and I've jumped to the defense of our magistrates, because I have appeared before many of them, and I don't even remember myself, because sometimes, you know, I wouldn't jump to the defense of a South African police because I have experience.
Yes, I agree.
But as a lawyer, the decorum, the respect, the line that we walk, even when we know each other, even in a disciplinary hearing where somebody's a chair, if I'm the chairperson of a disciplinary hearing, I will not cross the line. And the question that I want to ask you, as somebody who's been a judge for as long as you have, would every occasion that I've jumped to the defense of the judiciary, was it justified? Or should I have said, but look into the fact, tell me the fact? Or my blanket defense, was it justified?
I suspect the answer to that is what people are giving as an answer, Michael, to why they're stopping the J&J vaccine when it's six people who get blood clots and 20 million have taken the vaccine. Mm. Meaning, you know, I can't tell you that in every single case, you know, there's been impeccable behavior. It would be highly surprising to me in any institution mm-hmm. where there weren't one or two dubious actors. But I would say this, that, you know, in 20 million cases, as it were, the overwhelming 99.999% of cases, there's no doubt in my mind that we have a judiciary of impeccable quality. Meaning, I'm not saying every judge is a brilliant judge. I'm not saying, you know, I myself have made many mistakes in my career. And, I'm sure clients have been disgruntled. You know, they say, what the hell was that judge making when he came to that conclusion? Mm. I made a mistake. Mm. Judges do make mistakes.
Not the mistake, the corruption.
Well, that's the point. I don't think judges are corrupt. I mean, I have never heard of anybody on the take. I've never seen it happen. I can't swear to it,
yes.
Because I obviously don't know, and I'm not prepared to do that. I mean, and I say there are allegations now being made. They need to be examined. They need to be proved. They need to actually be dealt with properly. But I would say I would be highly surprised if this affected more than a couple of people at most. I don't even know if there are those, but I'm just simply saying I'm just taking an ordinary statistical figure. But in the vast majority of cases, the disgruntlement is because judges have made mistakes. And the judges and the magistrates are under enormous pressure. Mm. An ordinary judicial function or a magistrate's function, these are very badly resourced. Most of our computers, our internet goes down for days on end. We don't have proper research materials, other than in the Constitutional Court and to a lesser extent in the Supreme Court of Appeal. There are no clerks available to judges to assist. Hmm. We're not in a well-resourced situation. Judges are under incredible pressure to deliver judgments, that they make mistakes, egregious mistakes perhaps, mistakes which would say to a client, how could that possibly be but for? Hmm. The answer is it's not but for. It's just simply because the human limitations are such and the lack of resources that judges encounter on a day-by-day basis, and magistrates even more, just claim that. So, yes, I think your defense is a justified one, and it's one that I make consistently. I think we've got a very fine judiciary. We're lucky to have it, and so may long it may have lasted.
Okay, that's assuring, and thank you for that. There's talk of a probe. Do you think it's warranted? Do you think that might, because, you know, so there's things one gets in WhatsApp groups, and more recently there's an audio going around, a direct attack by somebody very high ranking on Judge President Mlambo. And I'm not sure if it's public knowledge, but I assume it is, because I tend to get the news second last.
And let me say this about Judge President Mlambo. I have a pious to God is perhaps not strong enough, right? I am deeply admiring of Judge Malamba. I've sat with Judge Malamba. I know both in, as a head of court and in cases. He and I sat on the Cerruti Commission a review together. He is a fantastic judge president and a great human being. I'm not surprised that there are attacks on Judge Malamba because he's a fiercely independent and hugely competent judge. And as I said to you, rent seekers will stop at nothing. They will stop at nothing to actually undermine judges who try to do their job. But now, unfortunately, if you get, for example, politicians who come along and say there were judges on the take to the Zondo Commission...
Let them come forward.
Well, yes, but then I'd like them to come forward and name the judges.
Yes.
And then we can have a proper inquiry.
Exactly.
This kind of sneaky nonsense where you literally rubbish people in the nameless fashion without any substantiation. And let me say this. I'm not on Twitter, so I don't know what the hell goes on there.
Are you missing out, Judge?
No, I'm not. It keeps my blood pressure at a normal level, Michael. But, of course, people tell me. And when I hear some of the stuff that's there, unsubstantiated rubbish about judges, about panels, about tribunals, it's just nonsense. And quite frankly, much of it, people should be hauled before the courts and basically be suspended for contempt, sentenced to contempt.
And why don't we do that? Because I think has the time not come for that? Because I think people are liberally, and I'm not talking, a random person. I'm talking very senior.
I would do that. I would certainly do that. And I have. In my early career, the then Attorney General of Western Cape, Frank Kahn, went onto the radio and slagged me off in no uncertain terms, and I issued a contempt against him. And he had to get two silks to represent him, and he finally, the silks advised him that he was in contempt, and he had to apologize fulsomely. Thanks to their intervention, the matter never went to court. But the point was, I was prepared to pursue it, not because I wanted to do that every day, not at all. It's not exactly. I accept readily criticism. Don't like it. None of us do. But it's part of the job. That when you say, attack somebody during a few days and in an unsubstantiated way, call them a crook, call them corrupt, without any substantiation, or say things which actually undermine the institution of the bench through attacking a judge, that's contempt. You've got to deal with that.
All right. So I've got two more minutes, Judge, and I'd like to leave it to you to give us your parting shot. And well, it needn't be about this question around the judiciary. It can pretty much be whatever it is, because I think this is, for us, an important show that anybody listening at home just would want to know what's randomly on your mind.
What's randomly on my mind, Michael, is that I think we've got a great constitution in theory, and that constitution has been translated into many areas which have changed the lives of many of people who are subjected to the egregious forms of racism and sexism under the previous regimes. But I do think that, for me, the most worrisome thing now is in the sense that we capacitate a state right across the board so that it can vindicate the constitutional promises. It's no good judges making orders which the state can't implement. So what is giving me a great deal of anxiety is, to what extent are we now capable of actually delivering the water, the education, the housing, the general infrastructure to what I would regard as presently disadvantaged or historically disadvantaged? That's what keeps me up at night. What gives me hope is I think there are people of goodwill on all sides who understand this, and I think we've reached an inflection point in South Africa at present in which people realize exactly what you and I have been talking about for the last while, and that it is very important to stand up and be counted. And the fact is that people, and I, for example, just now, am now doing work for SARS. I'm enormously encouraged by the SARS staff, by the people there, incredibly dedicated, from all sorts of backgrounds, who have one thing in mind, to make SARS the best institution it possibly can. And that kind of spirit, I think, you find in many parts, and that's why I think we will, in fact, rise to the challenges which unquestionably are before us now.
One of the suggestions that you have, and you make the point that there's about only a mere 5,000 South Africans who declare tax above 5 million a year.
$5 million, yeah.
And you suggesting that you know, the your observations about, you know, cars out there and homes out there indicate quite the opposite, that there shouldn't be 5,000, there should be a great deal more. How far along is this conversation about lifestyle audits? Because I think it's been the talk for a while. And it seems to me that it's sort of a low-hanging fruit, as it were, to say, you know, you say you earn 35K, but you live in Clifton.
Yeah, and you got a Ferrari, yes. Mm. The answer is that, remember, these are recommendations which we made as the Davis Tax Committee to the minister and to the commissioner. And you'll notice that the minister took this so seriously that he's mandated SARS to do something about it, which clearly SARS are going to do. How they will do it and how they operationalize that is something which the commissioner can only answer, not me. Because I and my committee have made recommendations to this effect. It is for them to consider them. But I'm very encouraged by the fact that in the budget, the minister absorbed those, and in a sense, those are going to be dealt with, I assume, in the manner in which the commissioner can. Let me say, commissioner is doing a very fine job in totally repurposing SARS, and I'm confident that given the fact that these were undertaken, given by the minister, that you'll see some action coming in the near future. But about what it is, you have to ask the commissioner.
That's Judge Dennis Davis. I was going to ask you how's retirement, but it doesn't sound like you are yet to be acquainted with that concept.
No, I'm not retired.
Anyway, many, many thanks. I'm most indebted to you, and I'm sure I speak for Afropolitans when I say we really value your insight, your contribution to the country, but also the hour that you've taken to spend with us. Thank you, Judge.
With pleasure. Take care. All the best.
Thank you. Afropolitan, pleasure. We're back again next Wednesday. Good night.
That's a fine term. I agree with that.
The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng-Bell on Kaya FM 95.9. Kaya FM Podcast. Go to kayafm.co.za for more.